From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts. Tonight, you just left for work and had a non-specific feeling that something was happening to your place and it wasn't good. Dan?
Exactly, Tammy. It could be smoke damage, theft, or just too much caffeine, but you can't stop thinking about it.
But with renter's insurance through GEICO, your stuff is covered, so you don't have to worry.
And that's great, because the weekend is coming up and it's chock full of social obligations that are ready to fill that void.
Oh boy, will they, Dan? It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
Matt Haig, this is your third time on the podcast.
And third, it is.
Yeah. And if I could have you on every week, I'd be happy.
Yeah, I love it. I never feel more relaxed on a podcast than talking to you, Gabby. Oh. It's just so, you're so
this is
bright and breezy and just good to talk to.
Yeah, thank you. I get embarrassed, but that's very kind of you. But...
Okay, well, that's it. That's your.
This is in praise of you. So you have a cup of coffee, you've got some ice water.
Yes.
And you just sat down and said, I'm a bit addicted to coffee.
I am a bit addicted to coffee. And this is new for me because I used to have years of thinking I couldn't drink coffee because I was convinced it gave me migraines. But I think, I mean, I am quite prone to migraines, but I don't think... I mean, I might be having a migraine in 10 minutes. I don't think...
Yeah, if you suddenly say, can you put me in the dark? I'll know what's going on.
No, I don't think it's that correlated. I just really like coffee. I hear theories that people with ADHD, which I have, like coffee, but I don't know if it's that. But I always have to have something. And I think as things go...
Oh, that's interesting.
It's not the worst.
Yeah, it's what I mean, I gave up coffee before my mum died. She died nearly 30 years ago. And I just realised I'd had enough caffeine. Mm. And if there's ever any little bit, I can't take it because I'm so hyper.
I mean, I have to balance it right. Like, this is as late in the day as I can.
Are you going to be able to sleep tonight?
I've been on melatonin gummies for the last week, and just adjusting to sort of jet lag and things. So coming back from America and being away for a while. So I'm on the melatonin gummies as well. So my uppers and downers. It's a mild end of uppers and downers.
It's a very, very mild end of it. So Mr. Bestselling in America and the UK, and you've done it to me again. So, as you know, and I've looked at you in your face and said this to you, and every time anybody says, oh, what's your favourite film? What's your favourite music? What's your favourite book? I always say The Midnight Library, as you know, and I've said that to you many times. I think it's one of the most incredible, extraordinary books. I've bought it for so many people. I think it's life-changing. And then you've done it again. You've done what? I think I needed it. And I know you didn't write it for me, but I needed next bit. Yeah, just for me. Oh, thank you.
That's really good. Because obviously it's a bit scary having another book with Midnight in the title. That's not exactly a sequel. It's kind of a spiritual companion.
It felt like a friend to the other one.
Yeah, a friend. I always say sibling because I think it's having they're related, but they're having a slight disagreement. I feel like The Midnight Library is saying something that's slightly different to what The Midnight Train is saying. And I agree with both of the things it's saying. I think The Midnight Library is saying the grass isn't always greener. There's no point drowning in what ifs. Because you have no idea, you know, but you could win the lottery, you could become a superstar, but that doesn't necessarily mean what you think it means. And that's what it's saying. And I totally agree with that. Midnight Train is a little bit more active. I think it's a bit more of a tougher lesson. It's about, if we could have the perspective of the future on now, how would that change things? How could we find a way to be nostalgic about the present and realize these are the good old days? Because it's so easy, isn't it, with photographs. You have a photograph taken today and you can easily think, oh, I look dreadful, I look old, I look tired. You think of all the stresses going on, oh, I'm late for the podcast, oh, this email hasn't been sent, oh, this, that, and the other. And in 10 years' time, you'll A, think you look young and fabulous, and B, you won't remember any of the stresses. You'll just remember who was around in your life at that time, and you'll remember happiness. So imagine if we had that future perspective on now, the sort of step back on the close-up, you know.
Well, it's all about living in the moment. And it's something that I go on and on about because we only have whether whatever your religious belief, right now, this moment, we will never have as Matt and Gabby again. That second is gone. It's gone. And I know that and lots of people will say, oh, it's so trite to say live for the moment and everything can be okay. No, of course it can't be okay. But we have to appreciate the moment and think about the future. Yes. And remember the past, but don't wallow in the past and don't think, oh, well, if this happens.
And I think it's increasingly important. I think that it's no coincidence that we have everyone, you know, the whole world and his wife seems to be yabbering on about mindfulness and living in the moment. And there's a whole genres of books around it. Me and you have contributed to this as well and stuff we talk. But I think the reason is that it's suddenly risen up in recent years is because a lot of the world is designed to take us away from that. So we need these continual reminders because it's very easy to get sucked into the sort of treadmill of, you know, needing more X, Y, Z, whatever it is, whether it's fitness metrics, whether it's earnings, whether it's status, whether it's followers, whatever it is, we're in this system of not enough. So we're always striving for the next thing. So we're all plugged into a kind of addiction. And obviously, like these technological companies, they have very clever people and psychoanalytical analysis done on them to sort of encourage us to all be addicted
to these things.
So we're increasingly manipulated in ways we don't understand. So I think it's more and more important to, you know, focus on the human stuff, to focus on the present tense. Obviously, it's natural to have anxieties. It's natural to have worries about getting older and losing people and aging and stuff like that. Yet, you know, there's no point, you know, spending your entire existence consumed beyond anything else on that stuff, because that isn't living. That is a sort of like death in life anyway. So it's got to be, I think there's a perfect balance where actually the fragility and anxiety of life can actually enhance life. Because as you say, living in the moment comes from an acknowledgement that we're not here forever. We're not eternal creatures. We're not, you know, we have this one life and it's beautiful and it's long enough if we want it to be. And if we sort of live for ourselves and for the people we care about in a way that's not harmful for us or others. And, you know, that tries to bring a little bit of hope.
Yes, and that's a really important word, especially at the moment.
Yes.
I think, because, you know, we're very aware, and thank you for all of your posts about it, but we're very aware of what's happening in the world. And I think that's why I go on about joy so much, and that's why I do this, and that's why I try and do as much joyful stuff, because I think the let's just call them the good and bad people. The bad people are very loud. There are lots of good people out there, but we don't hear them as loudly because the bad people are very loud. Does that make sense?
Yes. And also, the nature of screens and looking at things, we're looking at the sensational edges. There's a statistic. I won't get too boring about statistics, but there's a figure anyway that I like, and it's called Dunbar's number. And Dunbar's number is 150. There's this very clever professor at Oxford University called Roger Dunbar. And Dunbar's number is 150 because he was a social anthropologist, and he worked out that naturally a human being is capable of knowing 150 people. That's our kind of limit. That is why, if you go back through history to the earliest communities and villages, they tend to average around 150. The average population of a village is somewhere between 120, 170. It always averages around 150 people. And now, of course, we're in such an unnatural and distorted age. We can see 150 new faces before we're even out of bed. So we're sort of overwhelmed by other lives. And we're not seeing necessarily the cross-section of the village. We're seeing exceptionally good people, exceptionally bad people, as you're saying, exceptionally talented, exceptionally beautiful, exceptionally rich, whatever. We're seeing the extremes out of the 8 billion on Earth. We're seeing the very extremes of that. So obviously that has some sort of mental effect if we're not careful, if we're not having that perspective over time, that this isn't real. These aren't a realistic representation of people, but also what we're seeing of them isn't a realistic representation of their lives. So it's doubly false. We're not seeing the random people we would be passing in the street, and we're not, you know, it's not part of a community in any sense. And also we're seeing their PR reel. We're not seeing, you know.
I mean, that goes hand in hand with, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but Toy Story 5.
No, I want to, though. I mean,
it's going to floor you.
Is it? I mean, Toy Story, which is the one where they're in the incinerator? Is that 3? Where they're mailed to?
This one, this one where all of the children are no longer playing with toys because they're all on screens. And there's a shot of every, Jess is looking up and all the windows have a glow and every child has got a screen. Yeah, and the children have got no friends. And it's, I mean, they're clever. Sad. But it is exactly clever. The way it's sort of, as you're saying, we're seeing this strange world and people, you know, for a like. And and it's very interesting. Somebody said to me a couple of days ago, why do you hide your likes on Instagram? And I said, does that matter to you? And they said, it's really weird. Why do you hide them? I said, because it's not important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think, like,
it's not real.
I've got a theory. But, you know, when we were younger, like, you'd watch the news, and when it got to the money bit of the news, you would see the numbers and the graphs, and that was sort of separate. It was to do with the economy. Now, increasingly, our lives are that. We're all on graphs. We've got our Apple Watches. We've got our metrics. We're measuring everything. We're measuring our follower count. We're judging our popularity in this. We've become kind of like the economy has seeped into us in that sense. And so,
oh, that's fascinating.
So as soon as you turn yourself into a number, there can always be a higher number. Like, so I feel like if you want to feel infinitely valuable as a human being, you have to stop playing the numbers game. And that is one way to do it, to switch off the... And it's not about, like people think, oh, it's because you're not getting enough. Like, it's not that. Actually, I get more stressed on social media when the numbers are high. You know what I mean? Because you're playing that game and you get too addicted to it and there's too much dopamine. And then you get more into it and you have a little buzz and then you get depleted. So yeah, it's just that we're encouraged to be a sort of economy of people, aren't we, on social media, I think. But then you get outside into the real world and you see real things happening. You see, you know, you see teachers, like I walk the dog on Brighton Beach, so you're always seeing like a school trip or they're picking up fossils or someone's fallen over and the teacher's wiping their knee. And, you know, you're seeing real acts of not major kindness, but little bits of thoughtfulness that goes on. That's everyday life.
But your books are real. They're real, and real people are reading your real books. Is there ever a time that you... I mean, it's incredibly powerful. Your words are powerful, and even just your which I want to talk about in a minute, about what you said recently. But your books are real, and you've created these people that I feel I know terribly, terribly well, but it's I'm able to escape that way. And books are important. Love books.
Well, I always remember, like, when I was really ill, really mentally ill in my 20s, books were the only thing I could do. I couldn't even watch telly because I had panic disorder and everything was so stimulating. It sounds pathetic, but literally switching on the telly, music blasting out of a radio. I think I could just about manage like classic FM at a really low volume. But, you know, almost anything was too much apart from like opening the page of a book. And the books I were reading were my sort of children's books because I was back in my bedroom, back at my mum and dad's house. So I was 24 years old reading Winnie the Pooh because...
I love Winnie the Pooh.
I love it. When I'm asked about my favourite self-help book, I always say Winnie the Pooh. It's a mental health book. I've said this many times, but like,
totally agree.
You can look at it now and see every single character as an archetype of either sort of a mental illness, disorder, neurodivergence. You've got Eeyore with depression. You've got Piglet with anxiety. You've got, who else have you got? You've got Owl, who's possibly dyslexic. You've got Tigger with ADHD. You've got Pooh, who might be an addict to honey. That's my theory.
But I know, I don't know, but I totally agree with you. I remember that question growing up, and everybody would always, because I always said I loved Winnie the Pooh and I love Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland. So I love all of that.
I think there's something about children's stories that are so pure. Those ones.
Well, you've written those as well, and those are also magical.
Well, I feel like when I'm writing for adults, like if I'm getting stuck with it, I try and think of how would I do the children's story version of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You've never said that to me before. I love that.
And it works. That's why there's a train in that, because children's books are full of trains. Full of trains. Railway Children, Polar Express, everything. So you add a train and it becomes a story, especially a steam train. So the first draft of The Midnight Train didn't have a train. And it was very sort of like cult.
It didn't have a train. Where was it?
It wasn't The Midnight Train. It was called The Memory Thief, the first draft. And it was about a man at the end of his life, but it was much more sci-fi. It was in the future, he'd gone to some AI company to relive his life. And and it was a bit Black Mirror, a bit Christopher Nolan. It was fine. It was very high concept, but it wasn't a novel that I was wanting to write. And then I thought, this needs warming up. And so then you think of like children's books and
the train. Yeah. Oh, my word. Gabby Roslin Podcast. Books, but I mean, I know this is a National Year of Reading as well. And I was doing some stuff with the National Literacy Trust a couple of weeks ago. And the importance of getting books out to kids, but it's not just kids, it's adults. The importance of putting a book in somebody's hand. And on the train, I work in Manchester as well. And I go on the train and I sit there and then I think, I'm going to go for a walk and just have a look if I'm right. And I go up and down the train just for a little. Mm. And I chat to everybody. I'll chat to anybody. I'd say that the books are there, but not like they used to be, but everyone, and on every tube, and on every tram, wherever you want, everyone just has the screens. But books are important.
Well, books are important. I'm not too worried about the fate of the book.
No, neither am I. Sorry, I just mean that there are a lot of phones.
Because, you know, like, they've been around 5,000 years. But there are a lot of phones. But I feel it goes in swings. Like, I can remember, like, 2019, the figures were looking very bleak for books. Then one of the few silver linings of the pandemic years was that people went back to reading.
Yeah.
I suppose that's partly because a lot of other things were taken away. But I also think now with the young people, you know, if you look at the figures, you sort of do deep dive. A lot of Gen Z are returning to
books.
You know, just as they're sort of like discovering vinyl again, they're wanting a sort of physical thing. Bookshops are being sort of...
My daughter has just rather sweetly asked if she could have a book voucher for her birthday in a few weeks.
Oh, wow.
I said, what do you want? She went, I'd really like a book voucher. Don't choose my books for just like, because she loves books. And that just made me very happy.
Yeah, no, it is good. My son doesn't read novels. He's 18. He doesn't read what we would call novels, but he reads graphic novels. So he reads.
He's
reading. It's all reading. And I think it's about having a wide definition of what reading is.
Absolutely.
And so I'm not, I feel like there's signs of optimism there. And I feel like books continue to offer something that no other art form offers. Like, a book is a very subjective experience. Two people reading the same book are effectively reading a different book. It's a little bit true with film. Everything's subjective, but I feel like essentially with a film, you're watching the director's reading of the film. Whereas with a book, a lot of the directing
is
in your head.
I know those characters. I know who you have written about. You see them one way, I see them another.
Totally. And both are right.
I love that.
And this is one thing one annoying thing I think about modern sort of book culture is the average rating. Like, you know, everything has to have an average star rating. So every book ends up being about 3.8 out of 5. And that's fine. But it's like, it's such a subjective experience that a book can legitimately be 5-star and 1-star and be the same book, because it's about how the reader...
How somebody takes it.
How it takes it. And also in your own life. Like, a book that might really land well with me when I was 20 years old, probably at 50 years old, isn't going to have the same effect. But it doesn't mean it's a worse book. It just means you have to catch it.
But also it's what's happened in your life.
Yes.
Because I do think that adults, something, I don't know what age it happens, but suddenly people lose their imagination. And books give us our imaginations back. And they're really important things to be able to picture it, which I know that obviously the conversation that everybody has with you about your books being turned into films and TV shows and things. But and actually, I love it. And I love it when it happens to my favourite books. Mm. But it's always, I didn't think she was like that. It's that sort of feeling. But I like that. It feels interactive.
Yeah. I know, you can't really lose her as a writer, because if it's not quite as good, then people just go around saying, oh, it's not as good as the book. You almost want to put it in the contract. Just make it 10% not as good.
I love that.
Then you can say.
How does it feel? This is just something I was thinking coming here. How does it feel when you go to a coffee shop, or you're sitting on a train, or you're on an aeroplane or wherever, and somebody's reading a book and they don't know it's you that's written it? Has that happened?
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It feels like there's a moment of disconnection, like I don't know, because you're so used to seeing people reading books that it takes like a couple of seconds. It looks totally normal and you recognize the cover, and it takes you a second to realize that you are that person, and there's a little bit of separation.
Do you tell them?
I'm trying to think. I think there was a time, one person once, it was a grown up person reading one of my children's books on the London Underground, and I think I did, because they look very approachable. But generally,
I
no.
love that.
Generally, no. I'm just like, I don't know how to do that, Gabby. I'm not that good at just.
It's just, yeah. If I see somebody reading one of your books, and this has actually happened, I've seen people reading the Midnight. I've told you the story before, and I've said, "That's my favourite book. How are you enjoying? Are you getting? Are you waiting till you get this bit and this bit and this bit?" For you, do you know what's next? Do you always know what's next, or do you? Because we were talking about living in the moment, and your ideas, you never stop with it. Please never stop with your ideas in your books. Never. But do you ever know what's next? Picking up on obviously the midnight.
I'm quite
train.
Impulsive. Like literally, my last month, my next book has been three different books. So I never know until I'm properly underway. It could be anything. Literally, right now, my next book could be a new, totally, entirely new novel. It could be a sort of third and final Midnight, or it could be a nonfiction about my teenage years. Literally, I'm writing all three of those things.
You're writing all three.
Well, I've written bits of all three, but I'm not necessarily finishing all three.
But you will finish all three eventually?
Possibly, but it's
That's
more
quite
like...
That's quite exciting though, isn't it?
Yeah, but you have like... It's like a little shortlist or a competition to see which one goes further. I mean, there will definitely be... Now we've sort of expanded it into the Midnight World, we're going to... You can't have a Midnight World of two books. It's got to be at least three.
Yes.
So there's going to be a third, which is going to be more... of a sequel. It's going to be a kind of reversing of the Midnight Library, where Mrs. Elm, because we leave her at the sort of like fading in and out of life, Mrs. Elm is guided by Nora through a different kind of thing. And it's
My goodness.
So it's going to be more of a straightforward sequel with little touches of Midnight Train in it. So that will close the whole thing. And then I've also, I want to write about, because I was one of those kids who was branded special needs in nearly half my subjects at secondary school. And at that time, end of 80s, during the 90s, you were told you were special needs, but you very often weren't told anything else other than that.
That was it.
You were just a bit difficult for teachers or whatever. And so to write about that experience, because looking back now, post-diagnoses and things like that, autism and ADHD in my case, you know, you view, it wouldn't be a book necessarily specifically about autism, but it would be a book about what it was like in those sort of mysterious years where kids were often marked as different.
It's such a horrible expression.
Yeah, and special, but the special was never, you didn't want to be that kind of special. And, you know, so it was just a mark on you, and it lowered my self-esteem, and probably, you know, I'm not transferring blame over, but I was quite dysfunctional. I got arrested for shoplifting at 16. I drank and took drugs quite early in life. And so, you know, you wonder if you'd have had a proper, sensible diagnosis at 11 and put on some right medication, whether it would have been different. It might not have been. But it's quite interesting to look back at the 90s. And so I might have a book around, I might pick a year of like the year I was 16 or something, just like zoom in on that and what that was like. So it'd be a bit Reasons to Stay Alive, but a little bit earlier.
It's very interesting that you're saying about labels, because a friend of mine works with neurodiverse kids, and just she loves it. And she always says them that she calls it the superpower class, and they've all got superpowers. And it's so different than you saying, you're different. I mean, I had, you know, I was always...
It felt like the bin. It felt
like... You're shy. You're very shy. You're so shy. She's shy. She's shy. So she... And I'd be, okay, I'm shy. Because you're told it. You're told it all the time.
What gave you confidence in Gabby?
Because I really wanted to do television. That's all I wanted to do. Television. Obviously, I could then went into...
But that's interesting though, isn't it? Like, the shy kid wants to end up doing TV.
Yeah, but people... Then they'd always say... But you're very shy. You want to be a you want to do Blue Peter. You're so shy. I go, I'm very shy, but I want to be a presenter. But it's interesting, those labels that you give kids. You know, those the kids that you say, oh, well, you're different. It's all right, you're different. Oh, I hope that's changed now, though.
Not always, but I mean, my teenagers, my son has the diagnosis of autism, and he presented quite clearly quite early. But it's a kind of neutral to him. It's not like, oh, here's my autism card, and it's not like, oh, this is a massive stigma. It's kind of just a thing. But
that's
what
I mean, because now the way people are, people don't go, oh, they're, you know, none of that.
Yes, because it annoys me when politicians talk about it being fashionable. It's not fashionable. We've just got a better telescope.
We're
seeing what wasn't there, what wasn't, you know, understood. Before, you know, the stars were always there before we could actually see the other galaxies. So I think it's...
I love the way you look at the world, Matt. I really do. Well, if I may, I just want to pick up on something that you put on social media about the social media ban for under 16s.
Oh, yes.
And I loved what you said about... I mean, I'm for it as well. But that what you said, okay, now that's all well and good taking it away, but we need to give. We must give. We need a sense of community. We need... to put down those screens. We need, like I said, about Toy Story. Yeah. But those youth clubs, those communities.
Because there's a danger of people just, like people of our generations that can remember the before times and remember a life before social media and didn't grow up with social media. But we just think, okay, the answer is just complete banning kids from, but it's like, to do what? You know, they have got a culture now of being very indoors, you know, and my generation as parents, and I was definitely this as well, we had this kind of like fear of the outside world.
I've got kids the same age as yours, but I didn't say, just run out in the street.
No, exactly. And so it's not just for kids that have to change, it's the parents, and also it's the social structure. We need to massively take it seriously if we're really doing this. You can't just sort one side without sorting the other side. You can't just take the stuff away without replacing. And I feel like it's like when they've done studies on addiction, you know, people are less addicted to things if they have stuff around them that fulfills them in other ways. You know, the addict is often the person with no other stimulation in their life. So you have to make sure that the rest of life is interesting enough for, you know, if we're going to take away the phones, you can't... I noticed it myself as a parent. You'll often look at the problem, you'll look at them on the phone, but you're not necessarily presenting the alternative. You'll just say, you've been on your phone a lot. And it's like, and they're like, yeah, but what else am I going to be doing? So it's about having the alternative. And it might not be as simple as just starting up loads of youth clubs or whatever. But I definitely think it might need a little bit of clever thinking. But I think certainly like youth groups around interests, whether it be music, chess, Dungeons and Dragons, whatever it is, you know, groups and getting people out into the world and doing stuff. And then, you know, the kids who want to do climbing, the kids who want to be out in nature, they can be doing that. And, you know, there's ways.
And book groups. I do talks with book groups for young people from 18 to 24.
Yeah.
And they love their book groups. And it's a great way because they've got a reason to be there. They've got something to talk about. Talk about your books because they are brilliant.
My mum's in a book club and she bans them from doing my books. She's in, my hometown has finally got a Waterstones. I think we were like the 600th Waterstones or something, like within the last year. It never had a bookshop when I was growing up, Newark-on-Trent in Nottinghamshire. But she, my mum is a part of the Waterstones book club. But she has, it's not great business for me, but she's banned them from ever doing
because she doesn't want to, she said
she wants to wrap me in cotton wool and she wants to wrap herself in cotton wool. I was like, Mum, it's okay. There are 40,000 one-star reviews of the Midnight Library on Goodreads. If you want to look at them, it exists. You can allow people to have a negative opinion
that
of my book.
Do they actually stock the books?
Yeah, they stock the books. They're very supportive, actually, because Newark-on-Trent isn't, you know, hasn't produced that many writers. So I'm their star writer. Yeah. But yeah, my mum has got a very strict
ban on it. I love that. Matt, it's always such a pleasure. I know I've asked you before, I don't know if you have this time, but to bring in something that brings you joy or to share something.
I honestly find these tasks the hardest thing.
Oh, no, sorry.
I have got something. But it's probably not the kind of thing you're thinking.
No, honestly, people have brought
mentioned
all sorts.
Yeah, well, physical item, apart from a phone, that I take with me everywhere is two tennis balls and a sock, which is for my back. But it's also it's a relaxing aid because you sort of put it on your back and you have a spa treatment all day long. Wherever you go, if you're sitting on a train, it's two tennis balls in a sock. It's the most basic homemade thing.
I think my
daughter found it on TikTok when I was moaning about my back.
Please, can I?
Yeah. Okay, so it's like a massive ball. So you just lean against it.
Okay, I'm leaning.
And then if you're sort of fidgeting you don't have to move. So if you've got a knot in your back or a bit of pain, you just put it where
the
pain is.
Why did I never think of two?
I mean, it's physio.
Tennis balls in a sock
as you go.
Before. Oh, you see that? Oh.
And a car, long car journeys.
Do you want your tennis balls in a sock?
Well, you know, they are quite readily available things, Gabby.
Oh, you are just so wonderful. Matt Haig, as always, you can have your socks in a sock.
I feel bad now.
No, thank you, Gabby. Have them. Matt Haig, I adore you. You are a very, very special soul. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabby. I love that. Gabby Roslin Podcast.